Hello and welcome to Story Radio, the podcast for readers, writers and lovers of literature everywhere. Today we're talking to Mickey Lenton, whose book Winter Sun was published on the 13th March by Afsana Press. It's great to have you back on the show, Mickey.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what your book is about?
Yeah, so Winter Sun is a book about a holiday I went on with my father to Tenerife in 2005. I was around 30 years old at the time, and my dad was in his early 70s and pretty unwell. And I wanted to ask him a series of questions about why he was the way he was when I was growing up with him as a child. It's a book of autofiction, I suppose, so autobiographical fiction. So whilst we did go on the holiday in 2005, that actually happened, quite a lot of what is in the book has been fictionalised. So we don't really come to any conclusions by the end of the book. I don't want to spoil anything, but I suppose it's a book about father-son relationships and identity and I suppose growth and what it's like to grow up with someone who's very creative and intellectual, but also quite stubborn and difficult, and the complexities that I had of doing that as a child, I suppose.
Yeah, that was something that interested me actually, as to kind of how much it was kind of just non-fiction, the extent to which you did fictionalise things. Did you set yourself a set of rules before you started as to kind of what you would allow yourself to do in terms of fictionalisation?
I don't think I set myself a set of rules. I wanted to write about the holiday, and actually I think when you go on holiday with an ailing parent, some kind of strange things can happen. It can be a bit funny, it can be a bit quirky. It was a package holiday that my dad had booked as well. So in a way that was quite strange for him to have booked a package holiday. And the place that we stayed in wasn't that nice also. So we met different types of people. And actually some of the experiences that we had on the trip that I write about in the book actually kind of did happen. So for example, he did forget his diabetes medication and had to go to the doctor to get some more medication. He did feel very unwell one evening and sort of thought he had to see a doctor. We did bump into these walkers in this distant village, and we had a bit of an altercation with them because my dad wasn't feeling. So some of these things did actually happen, but I wanted to make it more dramatic. I wanted to make it more of a story. And I wanted there to be a sense of tension. I really wanted to grow that tension. And I felt, well, I'm not going to just be able to grow that sense of tension between us just by recounting things that happened. I needed to sort of fictionalise it to a certain extent. But I don't think I set myself any rules. I started to write, and then I realised that actually, in order to make this appealing for readers and in order to make this kind of a fun read as well, and a read that sort of would resonate with people, I had to build attention somehow, so I had to fictionalise things a little bit, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting, because some of the tension comes from the questions that you got looming. Mm. And I was kind of interested as to kind of whether those were exactly verbatim the questions that you had prepared, or whether you made them up, in fact.
Well, so at the time, at the time, I actually in the book, it shows that I was in therapy at the time, which actually is true. So I was seeing a therapist at the time. But I hadn't really discussed with my therapist, you know, whether or not I should ask my father questions on this holiday. And I didn't actually know what the questions would be until I got to the end of the book. So, again, without spoiling too much, I think, you know, I consistently go through this journey in the book trying to find the right opportunity and the right chance to talk to my father about these questions that I want to ask. But the reader doesn't really find out much until sort of the last few chapters. So I hadn't quite worked that out right from the very beginning. I'm not the best planner when I write. I don't always sort of plan each stage of what's going to happen. I think things come to me, and then I think I start to develop them as things progress when I'm writing.
It did feel almost like a MacGuffin, you know, just a kind of something which is a kind of goal to head to, but, you know, isn't in itself that important in a way.
Yeah, and I think you kind of want to, I don't know, I think I wanted to have something that was always at the back of the reader's mind as well, to kind of like think about. So where are these questions, and what are these questions going to be? And if I reveal them too early, then does that spoil things for the reader as well? And I think I wanted that to be some kind of release also towards the end, which allowed that kind of, you know, in the last couple of chapters, there is more of a dramatic moment, I think, and I sort of wanted all of that to come together somehow. So yeah, I suppose you're right. Yeah.
How did you find the experience of writing this compared to writing fiction? You're usually a short story writer, aren't you?
Yeah, so I've written a lot of short stories, I really enjoy this experience. I've always wanted to try to write something longer, and I wrote part of it during my MA, and then kind of put it aside for a couple of years after I wasn't originally able to sell it through an agent, and then came back to it sort of early in 2023 and then sort of rewrote it. It's not a very long book, it's only around 50,000 words. I think I really enjoyed, so I like to write about things that have happened to me, but I like to fictionalise elements of them. So I think I enjoy that. I suppose I'm not the kind of writer that can make things up, you know, completely, I suppose. People say to kind of write what you know, and I kind of think that's important, but I also think it's to write about what you don't know as well, to add that sort of element of surprise and fiction, because that sort of builds more of attention for the reader, I think. So to me, that became quite good fun, actually. I wanted to add elements of drama, and that, yeah, that just became, yeah, more of an interesting experience overall, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were there elements in The Holiday that you kind of felt it awkward about including or didn't include because they felt they were too uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think ultimately I'm talking about an elderly man here who was my dad, who I loved very much, and he's been dead 10 years now, so I did feel pretty awkward about writing about his well-being and his illnesses. You know, I depict in the book that he's got a very big hernia sticking out of his abdomen, which he did have. He had a lot of illnesses, and he was kind of falling apart slightly by that stage of his life. So I did feel a bit awkward about that. I felt awkward about describing him that way. But I also felt that it was important for people to understand that this is what old age can do to people, and I think it's not always pleasant. And so I thought initially that it might feel uncomfortable, but I thought I was telling the truth. I didn't want, you know, I think if you're going to depict an elderly old person, I think you have to do it properly. I don't think you can't sort of shy away from it somehow. And, you know, also there's an element that actually I was kind of exposing my dad to a certain extent, because he was a very well-known person in Ireland. He was a very well-known television and theatre director. And I was exposing the other side of him that people didn't necessarily know about. The fact that he was struggled with his identity, he struggled with depression, he struggled with perfection to a certain extent. He struggled with the fact that he didn't have many friends. And I think that was, I felt awkward about that to a certain extent, but I reconciled myself that actually in order to write the story, I kind of had to become more comfortable with that. And I didn't feel I was exposing him in a nasty way at all. I think I was exposing him through a loving way and wanted to, in an understanding way, as much as I could, really.
Were your family okay with?
Yeah. So both my mother and my sister are pretty okay with it. Over the weekend, there's just been a long piece that I wrote about him in the Saturday Irish Independent just yesterday, actually, which is a 1,500-word article about the book and about why I wrote the book. And I think my mother felt a little bit, you know, time is a really good healer, isn't it? So when after he died, I think my mother was still, to a certain extent, you know, we were all very upset, but he was very, you know, he's still very close, still very raw. It's a very raw emotion when somebody dies, I think. And I think as time goes on, you sort of soften a bit, don't you? And maybe the things that were a bit difficult, you feel that you begin to think that maybe they were less important. And maybe I've kind of exposed him slightly in this article in the Saturday Irish Independent and also in the book as being someone who was quite depressed and quite difficult, and reigniting that maybe is a bit difficult for them to read and to think about. But actually, I'm not telling something that wasn't untrue. Do you know what I mean? I'm not being voyeuristic or unpleasant about it. I'm trying to express, you know, a different side of an individual that perhaps people didn't necessarily know, and that side is important for me to not to expose, but to tell people about. Yeah.
There's a lot of reading in your book, especially Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, your father's favourite writers. I think the books that are mentioned are Herzog and Everyman.
Which
are both about older men.
Yeah.
I'd love to know a bit more about whether those writers were an influence on you too, and whether you saw them as a kind of extra narrative when you were writing this.
Yeah, so my father absolutely adored, you know, that style of sort of big American writers, John Updike, Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, definitely. I also mentioned the book Stefan Zweig as well, who he adored, and the book that I mentioned that Stefan Zweig wrote was called The World of Yesterday, which he absolutely loved, which is Stefan Zweig's kind of memoir, I suppose, autobiography, about his thoughts about how culture in Europe had died before the First World War, and with the sort of, you know, beginnings of nationalism through the First World War, and then he survived the Holocaust, the Second World War, and then fled to Brazil with his wife and then committed suicide. So it's quite tragic, quite a tragic story, I suppose. But yeah, and Herzog is about a man who lives in New York who's going through a lot of sort of mental angst, and he's going through quite a crazy divorce as well, and he writes letters to officials and to everyone he knows to try to sort of, you know, bring across his opinion about things. And I think my father loved the way that these writers were able to kind of express sort of middle-aged angst, and also sort of, you know, the angst of elderly male sort of life to a certain extent, in ways that that really resonated, I think, for an elderly Jewish man like my dad. And I think they certainly influenced me. I've read Herzog a couple of times and reread it as I was writing this book as well, only because I just wanted to remind myself. And I think there are passages in it that are absolutely brilliant. And I think towards the end of Herzog, there's a fantastic scene where basically he stops writing these letters, and he kind of feels that sort of, you know, he's kind of said everything that he can say, really. And in a way, that really resonated with me, because I kind of felt that my dad got to a stage in his life where he kind of felt that he could say everything that he could say. And those kinds of, you know, messages, I think, were very, you know, very prevalent for my father, I think. So that's, I think, one of the reasons why he loved those books. But also, yeah, they definitely influenced me. And also, my father introduced me to literature, and I love literature. I love, obviously, writing and reading. And I've read quite a lot of these books. And I know that a lot of these American Jewish writers divide opinion these days. But to me, there's still very significant works of literature that perhaps should be read, and I think tell us a lot about periods that they were writing in, especially post-Second World War writing, I think.
I'm not sure they're on the Birkbeck reading list.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, I adore Saul Bellow, and I really enjoy. I've enjoyed reading a lot of John Updike as well, and
I love Philip Roth particularly. Yeah. But I've started reading Herzog again.
These books are hard reads sometimes, and difficult, but you know, I still think they can tell us a lot about that society during that time, I think.
Well, the plot against America seems very pressing now, doesn't it? Because so much relates to Trump and
what's
happening.
And I think my father was desperate to, I don't know, I think especially with I don't know, the sense of kind of loss and being lost in the world and trying to find answers to things definitely kind of fitted the way my father kind of liked to think about things. And maybe that's also why he liked these writers. I think people like Bellow were kind of probably quite lost individuals, but they could express themselves through their work and through their writing. And I think that's maybe why he found beauty in those kind of works. Just like he found beauty in classical music. My father was obsessed by classical music, and he would always enjoy that aspect of losing himself within kind of classical culture. He really enjoyed that sense of exploring that world, I think.
You have sections between the chapters which are in typewriter font, which I assume are early letters from your father. Could you explain a little bit about how they work in the narrative?
One of the original kind of thought processes behind the book was that I found this bunch of letters that my dad wrote to me, and I just reminded myself of how funny they were and how ridiculous the kind of things that he wrote. I don't think he quite knew what to write in letters, so it was usually just like a stream of consciousness, actually, of things that had happened to him, or food that he'd eaten, or bottles of wine that he'd drunk, or how he'd cut himself with a carving knife, and you know, all that kind of stuff, and how much he missed my mother when she would go on work trips and stuff like that. And I just, it just occurred to me, these are letters are really nice in a way, and the whole idea about letter writing is within the book. It's, you know, it's kind of linked to what Herzog is doing in his, in Herzog, Moses Herzog does within Herzog, of writing letters. And I don't think my father was doing the same thing, writing letters to me. He's not sort of, you know, using letters to demonstrate against the government or city officials or anything. He's, but I just quite like that sort of link of writing letters, of being somewhere else and receiving these letters. So they play a role in kind of trying to build his character, and the letter excerpts that are in the book are actually real excerpts from real letters that he wrote to me. If you are to read the book, then you'll find that that's kind of quite a critical thing by the end of the book as well, the whole idea of letter writing. So we broke up these letters as sort of chapter breaks in order to sort of maintain that sort of sense of interest in them, so that the reader will eventually find out what's happening with these letters as they read on.
Yeah, I like the use of the typewriter font. Was it actually laid out exactly as in the letter?
Yeah, exactly. So my, you know, they were written on an old, really old computer, my dad, I think like an Amstrad or something, and, you know, on a dot matrix printer, and I've still got the actual original printouts. So we wanted to try to replicate, you know, sort of like early 90s, mid-90s kind of dot matrixy kind of style of printing. You know, he really, like a lot of elderly people, they struggle with like new technologies, and he, even when he was alive, you know, I remember him getting an Apple Mac computer once, and he just couldn't use it at all. It was just the hardest thing ever, and I think the simpler it was, the better. So, you know, and I used to love going into his office when he worked in RTE and playing with on his typewriter. He had one of those old-fashioned, you know, clickety-clack typewriters, which were quite cool.
It's like that with Richard Brautigan, who wrote his stuff.
No.
Trout Fishing in America. It's all kind of just in typewriter font. It just does feel like he's just kind of sat and typed it all out.
I quite like it. And also, I just think there's a, you know, I like the sound that they make, and I even quite like the sound of a dot matrix printer like coming to life. It's kind of like squealing to life.
For 200 pages, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Your writing is very observational and rich in detail. I love your descriptions, for example, of meals or people, or just the kind of way you describe what apparently very sort of mundane situations and kind of really home in on them. What's your secret? Do you keep a diary? Do you take photographs? How do you do this in your writing?
I don't keep a diary, and I don't take any photographs at all. I do like that aspect of writing, of trying to find like little details and things that are kind of like bring things to life, and I think that's kind of the nice way of doing things, is try not to describe everything, but try to focus in on one or two things and make it kind of quite, you know, kind of quite unique. And I think the meals aspect, the going out for dinner aspect of in this book with my dad was really important. He loved going out for dinner, so I knew that I had to bring those kind of meal occasions to life in ways that were kind of going to be interesting for the reader to read. And I really wanted to get across his the difficulty that he had with things like, you know, using pliers to open lobster shells, and, you know, the fact that, you know, the taste of food was really important to him. You know, the wines were really important to him. So no, I don't keep a diary or take photos necessarily. One thing that I do like to do though is, and I think I learned this, I can't remember who it was from, so I draw pictures of kind of maps of rooms or kind of locations, just like in a notepad, so that I can figure out what route I'm taking. So if, you know, a restaurant or a hotel is down a road or an alleyway, I just draw the map out from my mind into a book, and then I can find a way of describing it. I think now that this book was set in 2005, and I've only got a few photographs from that holiday, like literally a photo of me and my dad, a couple of me standing by a hire car, but I don't remember taking a camera on that trip. And this is the time before we had smartphones, so we weren't taking digital images then, so I think a lot of it I've just used, and, you know, from my memory. I bought a guidebook about Tenerife so that I could remind myself of things that are in Tenerife as well. And I do quite a lot of searching online to look at. One thing I do like to do, actually, I don't take photographs, I look at photographs of food that people take in restaurants, and I think that's quite a nice thing to, then you can use that as a way of describing things. Yeah.
Was it Nabokov? Because I remember there's a section where he talks about, in one of his books about writing, he says, always draw a map and a room plan of any...
Did he say that?
He did, yes. And I always tried to do it, and I always find it really quite a challenge, actually, trying to work out where my characters are and where they're going and that kind of thing.
And I think sometimes I sometimes forget that, like, you know, you've left somewhere, and actually you have to tell the reader that you've left somewhere, you know, do you know what I mean? So that's sometimes a tricky thing to do, yeah.
How did your view of your father change over the course of the holiday, and how did it change over the writing of the book?
I think I understand my dad a lot more now, and I think that's taken probably quite a long time. I think that the whole idea of going on holiday was somewhere warm and somewhere kind of comfortable. You know, if you go, having some heat inside your body, I think, is for him, was very important. I do think he liked warmth, and I think he was loved, obviously, by us and his family and people who knew him, definitely. But I think he wanted to feel that kind of warmth in his skin a bit more and in his life. And I think he always struggled with maybe a lack of warmth, maybe. And I think going on holiday for him was quite important to feel that kind of sense of warmth and comfort that maybe he didn't always feel that he had within himself. I think that came from an early age in his childhood. I think his parents were not very warm people. There's a whole scene in the book about the fact that he says he wasn't hugged ever by his parents, and I think that really, I think that really affected him as he grew up. He wanted to be loved. He wanted to be supported. He wanted to feel that sense of warmth. So I think the more I've thought about it, the more I've thought that actually maybe that's what he was looking for, a sense of comfort and warmth. And that's why he enjoyed going on these trips, and why he enjoyed actually being in the sun in general. So I think my view of him has changed. Yeah, certainly. I think
he
has
things he wanted to get from you, and do you think he got them on that holiday? Or did he just want salmon food?
I think he wanted to know that I was close to him and would appreciate him, which of course I did, and I still do, absolutely. And I think he wanted to feel that, you know, that he had my support. And I think he definitely had my support, but I was also very frustrated by him because he didn't always allow you the space to disagree or to he didn't want to necessarily take on your viewpoint. And that became over time just quite, I suppose, sort of a bit tricky, really, in a way. And when you don't want to constantly battle with your parents, really, do you? On the one hand, I think he wanted that sense of support and warmth. On the other hand, he just wanted to argue and discuss constantly. And sometimes you also want just to have a bit of normality and peace, which actually I think genuinely is what he wanted, but he struggled. He struggled with that, I think. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I know the answer to that question.
He had a list of questions.
I don't think he had a list of questions for me. No, I don't think so.
So would you recommend Tenerife as a place for a week of family bonding? Would you go there with your kids?
Well, I haven't been to Tenerife since. Actually, I've been to Lanzarote a couple of times, but not to Tenerife. Actually, funnily enough. I don't know, we had it was a fun kind of week away, 9 days away, if not sort of slightly fraught. This is the thing about going on family holidays, is how often have we all been on family holidays, and sometimes they're absolutely brilliant, and everyone's getting on like a house on fire, and sometimes it's an absolute disaster. And I think there's a bit in the book where, I in the book I befriend the holiday rep, so the guy who's kind of looking after all the guests in the hotel, and he at one stage says something like, well, you know, most people come on holiday and they're like having a really horrible time at the beginning, but they start to relax and then they get into it. But he says, you guys are different. You're like, you seem to have got worse as the holiday has gone on. And so I think family holidays can either be fantastic and great, or they can be difficult and quirky. And sometimes people don't want to necessarily be so long with their loved ones because they just begin to annoy each other.
Did you go on the bar tour?
Did I go on a pub crawl?
Yeah.
Well, I went out one evening. It wasn't precisely as depicted. But,
I was happy you were going to be wearing the t-shirt.
I don't have the t-shirt now. I'm glad you're a close reader, Martin. Yeah.
So, what's your next project?
So my next project is a book that I'm writing about another trip I went on with my other, with my mother actually, to Romania. My mother's family originally from Romania before they moved to Palestine just as the Second World War was starting, and my mother wrote a book about going back to Romania in 1984 during the period of Ceausescu's regime. She travelled there in 1984, and then she wrote a fictional piece about her family leaving Romania. And me and her had wanted to go to Romania for ages, but we couldn't because of COVID, and then eventually we went around a year ago on this trip to go to the places where my mother had been in the 80s. And it was a very odd trip. Parts for a variety of reasons, it was a really bizarre trip. And so I'm writing a sort of semi non-fiction book about a middle-aged man who goes to Romania to find a house in Romania where his grandmother was born that his mother has asked him to save. And that's all I'm going to say right now. So it's kind of based on this trip that I went on, but also partly fictionalised as well, because I'm keen to sort of bring certain elements into it.
Mm.
So the ghostliness of Romania is in it, and I bring in a lot of kind of Romanian film and books that I've read as part of my research. So I'm hoping it'll all come together at some stage.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Really interesting.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Mickey. It's been lovely to have you back at Story Radio again. Apologies for my noisy dogs.
I love your noisy dogs. They're great. They're such fun. No, thank you for having me. It's always lovely to see you guys. Mm.
And as the dogs are actually asleep, maybe you could do a quick reading?
I could do a quick reading, yeah. Winter Sun. This was the last holiday I went on with my father. Day 1, steak tartare, Friday, December the 12th, 2006. The 8:20 flight from Dublin to Tenerife was delayed. A cold breeze circulated with the hot air of the cabin as we waited for the doors to close, the seatbelt sign to ping on, and the relief of the airplane to push back. My father, who I called Abba, father in Hebrew, dozed next to me in the aisle seat of row 12. Now in his mid-70s, he craved an annual dose of winter sun, hoping it would help relieve him of his tzores, his troubles. My mother usually accompanied him on his pilgrimage to the Canary Islands. This year, she refused to go. I protested that I had better things to do and suggested that he enjoyed his own company, so couldn't he just go alone? But she insisted. She needed me to look after him. She told me he enjoyed my company. I was between jobs. I didn't really have anything else on. So I finally agreed to be his chaperone. Abba had removed his sandals and socks, exposing his calloused feet and stretched out his legs. A muscle man sat in the window seat, bulky headphones on his head, his sharp elbow occupying the armrest to my left. I was squashed tight in the middle. Earlier, Abba had insisted that it was too far to walk to the departure gate, so I booked the airport buggy. The driver and other passengers, though, weren't amused by his frequent toilet stops and detour through duty-free to pick up a bottle of Jameson's whiskey, where he also took the liberty of tasting a single malt that he managed to spill onto his smock. While he was drinking, I knocked over a bottle of aftershave with my backpack, an edge of the thin, transparent glass chipping on the ground. No one seemed to notice, and pretending it wasn't me, I kicked the splinter of glass under a counter, replaced the bottle on the shelf and rejoined Abba on the buggy. I told myself the damage was nothing as the buggy drove away, but the bottle was chipped on the edge, a bit like me. Half an hour after taking our seats, gusts of wind lifted the airplane through icy drizzle over Dublin Bay into heavy clouds, leaving my empty stomach behind. Abba laid his warm hand on mine, his wedding ring resting firmly on my knuckle. I closed my eyes, pushed my head back against the headrest, and wondered when it had last been cleaned of other people's greasy hair. With every shudder the airplane made, I pulled my seatbelt tighter, gripped the armrests, and repeatedly read the instructions on the safety card that was laminated onto the back of the seat in front. How would I get Abba out in an emergency, I wondered. In his state, there'd be no way he'd be able to scramble through the cabin aisle to safety. Would I just leave him, alone, waiting to be rescued? 10 minutes later, the seatbelt sign chimed off. I climbed over Abba, went to the bathroom, and looked at myself in the backlit mirror. He often moaned that my posture was curved and that I should see his marvellous Feldenkrais practitioner who would put me right. I stretched my shoulders back until I stood straight, but they sprung forward, as if my body preferred to hunch. My eyes were bloodshot and eyelids baggy behind my glasses. My forehead was creased with concern. I tried to freshen up by splashing some water onto my unkempt beard and running my wet hand over my balding head, but the tautness in my face remained. A bout of turbulence shook the airplane, so I sat on the closed toilet seat in the cramped cubicle, one hand clutching the handrail until it passed. Rummaging through my wallet, I removed a piece of lined A5 paper I'd been meaning to look at. The sharp folds had nearly worn through the fibres, so I unfolded it carefully, stared at my messy handwriting and silently read 5 questions I'd brought to ask Abba while we were away. I caught a few glimpses of how I might ask these questions, maybe over dinner or during a drive, but the thoughts quickly faded. I left thinking nothing much, apart from an image of my Ima, mother in Hebrew, waving at the taxi earlier that morning as we drove away from my parents' house in Harold's Cross in Dublin in the dark. Breathing heavily, I delicately folded the piece of paper and slid it back into my wallet, wiped the sink with a paper towel, and listened to the suds get sucked into the bowels of the fuselage.